sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
NASDAQ at record highs. Google, Microsoft, Amazon, killing it. Apple earnings coming on Monday. Greece finance minister is mocked. Our guest today, Fausto Puglisi. All this and much more on episode number 410 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello, welcome. Andrew Horowitz here. I hope you're doing well. Hope you're having a good start to the warmer season that we're having. Seems that there's some real warmth out in California with the droughts going on. Pretty substantial amount of damage being done right now. And some nice weather sweeping across the country. Actually, down here in Florida, it's quite sunny, not a cloud in the sky. Beautiful weather. So come on down and visit. Anytime you're down in Fort Lauderdale area, give it a shot. We'll try to get together. We have lots to talk about and a great guest today as well. We've seen that markets finally, after 15 years, the NASDAQ has hit an all-time high. A lot of discussion about whether or not there's a bubble, questions being asked as to what is going on. But we did see that there's a lot of enthusiasm over the news that Google had some decent numbers, Microsoft beat and did well, and Amazon split out their profitability and their earnings from their cloud storage facilities and networks and really impressed the street. There was some discussion initially when Amazon came out with their earnings last week that numbers look kind of soft moving forward. The guidance that they gave was pretty soft. Once again, looks like they're in a spending mode. But when you took in consideration some of the earnings that you saw and the revenue from their cloud storage, wow, pretty impressive. Amazon really powering ahead, up about, I think it's close to 50% this year. After Jeff Bezos obviously heard the street and saw that it was necessary to provide a much better result in terms of their earnings and maybe tone down some of the spending, and also the realization that some of that spending that they're doing on their warehouses and delivery systems have really been paying off pretty well. Not to mention the fact that adoption rates of users that are saying, hey, you know what? I'm not going shopping in the stores anymore. I'm just going to easily get a maybe $75 or $100, whatever it costs exactly right now for a Prime membership. Get those deliveries the next day or 2 days later for free. Great return policy. I mean, think about what Amazon really offers. They offer the best process for merchandise that you really can imagine. I don't know about you, but we use Amazon quite regularly. And if I can help not going to a store, assuming I know what I want, well, Amazon, for almost any product that you could imagine, is really the first and one of the only places that I go to get it, because they have products from manufacturers that are very easy, all sizes. Delivery is quick. They even deliver, by the way, this is really interesting. I don't know if you've noticed this, but if you order something on a Friday on Amazon Prime, they try to deliver it on Sunday. They get the U.S. Post Office delivering. This is pretty impressive. The U.S. Post Office is delivering on Sundays. So when we order on a Friday, I have to think about where we're getting that order delivered to, because they're going to try to deliver it. Actually, on a Thursday, they could deliver it on a Saturday, Friday on a Sunday. And they'll keep on trying to deliver it if they can't get it to the office. But I think pretty amazing that they're so committed to this great service of delivering on time, not to mention the Amazon Pantry and all that. It sounds like an Amazon commercial here, but I got to tell you, if you haven't really tried the whole Prime setup, I encourage you to try it out. Really a great process, and that's why the stock is doing so well. Google missed their earnings by a bit, but overall, it was still an excellent earnings there. One of the big problems that we're seeing, that their paid clicks, their cost per click is down. And that's been weighing on shares. I'm not sure why the stock popped as much as it did. Microsoft had some decent numbers as well. And you add those up. You add Google, Microsoft, Amazon, the market cap of those, and put that into the whole NASDAQ equation. Plus, you look at a Netflix and some of the other companies that have been reporting, like biotechs that have been on fire in the NASDAQ. And no wonder the NASDAQ has been peaking out and doing so well recently. So we see that the NASDAQ now is above and beyond all numbers that it posted in terms of the NASDAQ index, the composite index. And there's a lot of murmurs out there that, oh, are we entering into another tech bubble? But I got to tell you something, and you've read about this probably, you've seen this, and you can find this headline everywhere, this tech bubble question. And you've also seen this subtext of this of saying, well, you know, back in 2000, 1999, 1998, the technology bubble that we were seeing was really based on a much different animal that was the NASDAQ at the time. A lot of the companies that were coming out were not making any money. There was no revenue to speak of. Earnings were in the negative area. And they were spending money, and the big word that you heard back then was the cash burn. You know, they got a cash burn rate that 45 days they're going to be out, and they're going to have to do another secondary or maybe a bond issuance or something like that. And that's much different these days. Today, these companies are making money. They're making a lot of money. Not all of the companies. I'm talking about these major companies. You know, Google, Microsoft, Amazon, they're making some serious bank. They're putting away a tremendous amount of money. They're doing buybacks. They have more money in cash on the balance sheets than probably, I would say probably, just pick one of them, have more money on the balance sheets than any company combined back in 2000 in terms of tech. What do you think about that? That's a guess of my part, but I think that's probably pretty accurate. You take the cash on the balance sheets for Google, and it probably was more than all of the companies in the technology area back in 2000 in total. That's how well they're doing. And the companies that are underlying the index otherwise, for the most part, are doing well also. You look at some of the other plays in the biotech area, also in technology. So this whole idea of a tech bubble, now it may be frothy. We may have valuations that are a little bit high on some companies out there. But generally speaking, this is not the same thing. This is a much different NASDAQ today. And took all this time, because it was such froth and such bubbly activity back then, to breach the level and get to a new historic high. Pretty impressive. The S&P also increased over the week. Dow, S&P, NASDAQ, about 2% on the Dow and the S&P, about 3% or so on the NASDAQ for the week. But the S&P got to a new record again for the week. Another new record. Ding, ding, ding. And just by a hair, just by about 0.4 of a point. So we are hitting on new records. Now, overall, when you look at earnings season so far, we've seen about 70%, 74% or so of companies are beating on EPS. And that's good, except for the fact that we do note that there was a much lower bar set. We saw that there was supposed to be about a 5.5% drop in earnings this quarter. So far, analysts are changing that. Now they're thinking about more like a 3% drop. So we're seeing a 3% drop, companies actually beating estimates, and that's why we got the revision from about a 5% drop to only about a 3% drop in earnings. About 45 to 50% of companies are beating on revenue, but a lot of the discussion is still about dollar headwinds, talking about oil issues, talking about the hedging issue, talking about the softness of the global economy. All these things are going into play. But what's really interesting is that markets, once again, are at a high, but we're seeing a drop in earnings. And in fact, we're looking outward, and guidance is still a little soft. Guidance from many of these companies have been soft. Now, you did see something like a Starbucks, Dunkin' Donuts come out, and guidance was actually pretty strong compared to where the thought was of when all these companies were going to be and how this global slowdown and the dollar currency headwinds were going to be very difficult on all of their earnings. The good news is things are back. Back to the whole idea of, hey, you know what? Companies beat, reasonable amount of earnings, decent revenues, a Fed that is probably going to hold off for some time on any kind of adjustment to their policy because we are seeing economic conditions pretty weak. Durable goods orders that came out on Friday were pathetically slow. If you strip out the transportation and some of the major numbers that were put in for the transportation index and some major buys that were done, we saw a pretty good drop in durable goods orders overall. Missing estimates and by a far amount, really probably going to bring down GDP numbers in the next quarter. One way that's good because those who are relying on stimulus and stimulative efforts by the Fed, or at least not changing their policy, they're pretty happy. That's good news. We saw this happening in China. Every time we see a weak number out of China, Chinese markets pop. Why? Well, it's very simple. Well, we hope for more stimulus. We hope for liquidity, low rates. And that's what's going on. 30 different stimulus efforts around the world so far in 2015. We talk about this in our latest economic commentary, talk about the effects of this. And by the way, if you haven't gotten that, we did send that out, a link on Twitter. Just follow me on Twitter at Andrew Horowitz, one word. Andrew Horowitz is my Twitter handle there, Twitter name. And we did send it out through that, sent it out to our clients, sent it out to people who had requested information previously. If you didn't get that commentary and you want it, we send this out quarterly. Send me an email to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com and I'll pop you out a copy of that. And it talks about this whole idea of what's going on around the world, some of the conditions that we're seeing now. Talked about the whole idea of love is in the share. That's how we titled it. If you remember that song from the 70s. This whole idea that, man, companies really love themselves. The buyback numbers, the dividends, what they're doing with their cash, how they're deploying it rather than any kind of major capital expenditures for maybe changing their company and benefiting their company. They're doing a few things. What? Number one, acquisitions. Number two, they're doing buybacks. Number three, they're doing dividends. They love themselves and they love the companies around them to kind of bring in all sorts of opportunity for the balance sheets. Obviously, the first two that we mentioned there that do not do anything for anybody besides boost the earnings and benefit the shareholders are the increase in dividends and the share buybacks. Mergers, acquisitions, the opportunity for companies to expand and grow through acquisitions. That's something that's important. And with a low interest rate environment and many other avenues really running out to increase the company's revenues, this is going to be something we're going to continue to see for a while. We saw it in a bang-up way, just absolute incredible way in the biotech area. Probably going to see a lot of that in the oil services area. And it looks like that technology is going to continue to see some of that play as well. One of the big ones we've been watching recently is the whole Teva for Mylan, Mylan for Perrigo. We've been watching that at all. This whole battle that's going on. Teva wants to buy Mylan. Mylan says, hey, screw you. We don't want to merge with you. We want to buy Perrigo. That whole thing is going round and round right now. We also saw that the Time Warner and Comcast deal is now off the table. Kind of interesting, freeing up money maybe for other competitors like a Charter to be bought. We'll talk about this and some other things coming up. Also, what's going on with Greece. And we'll kind of give you some ideas of what's happening for the next week to come as well. Some other things that we're going to talk about right after our guest. Let's get right to it. And today we're talking with Fausto Puglisi. And he is CEO of Cyber Trading University. He's one of the early SOS bandits. We'll talk about that in a second. I'll get him to explain what that means. He dominated stocks in the 1990s. He semi-retired, a very successful trader in his early 20s. He is a 12-time champion of the Money Show Traders Challenge and is known for his live trading events where he goes and gets to prove how well he's trading and teaches it to people like you on what to do. So, Fausto, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me again, Andrew.
I have a list of things I want to talk to you about because, you know, I get a lot of questions from listeners. A lot of questions about, you know, how do I start trading? Where do I begin? What do I do? You know, I look at charts on Yahoo or I look at this or that. And kind of sometimes it strikes me as the idea that people think it's a kind of easy to just trade, easy just to get in, use some kind of a smartphone app or do something that they can easily just push a button and make money. But one of the problems is that I find, at least, is that a lot of people don't take the time to get education. That's kind of where you come in, right?
That's right. That's right. You know, and people get very frustrated. And you know what it is? Andrew, we've been trading for a long time, and you just know that. And I love trading, and I love teaching more than anything because I hate seeing people lose money. And I have a passion to do it. But the reason why is that everybody thinks there's a crystal ball out there. Everybody makes things more complicated than what it really is. And it just when you try to show it to them a little bit more how simple it is, they're like, it really can't be that easy. Is it really A to B? No, you got to go from like A to Z. and they start, you know, like we're talking about earlier, we'll get into chart patterns, we'll talk about tools that they need and stuff like that. But, you know, the number one thing that everybody has to have is great traders, you know, never stop learning. And, you know, once you think you know more than everybody else, that's when you start losing.
Yeah.
But getting started, you gotta find that mentor, and you gotta start making things more complicated than what it is.
So one of the things that you mentioned there is, you know, you hate to see people lose, you know, obviously, unless they're on the other side of your trade, right?
Exactly.
Right. But one of the things that I think the basic lessons that people really have to start looking at is, okay, well, how do I trade? And what I mean by that is not what to trade. See, I didn't say what to trade. I'm talking about how to trade. You know, do I go after a stock on the ask? Do I hit it on the bid? Am I going to split it in between? Am I going to chase a stock, look for maybe it to eclipse a certain level? But one of the things that I've noticed is a lot of people will hold back trading, particularly when it comes to, we'll call it short trading, like swing trading. They're waiting for a penny or two or three to come down to them, and they won't get it because, oh, I don't want to get at this price. Where is it that we start to hold out for a price, and where is it where we attack a stock and just go after it at the current price?
You know, that, Andrew, that's a great question, and it's funny that you bring that up because I actually did an event today, a big event, and few people kind of mentioned the same thing about, how they always feel like they're delayed. They always feel like they're chasing. Well, this is one of the issues that people have. First of all, the chart is obviously, it could be blamed for that, and I'll tell you why. The problem with a chart is that it's delayed. And then what happens, everybody's waiting for the chart to make the move, and by the time it makes its move, the stock's already moved already. So they're sitting there watching the chart, and they're like, okay, do I buy it now? Do I buy it now? Meanwhile, the stock, you know, as the chart's trying to catch up, and they're looking at a five-minute chart or a moving average, the thing's already, you know, 20, 30, 50 cents ahead of where you originally saw it. And then you're like, do I buy it here? Do I not buy it here? So, you know, if you kind of eliminate some of the bells and whistles, and just follow supply and demand, you know, and just go with your gut feeling, then always trying to back test yourself, you'll see you'll do more trades, and the more trades you do, the more you're going to learn. Because you're going to make mistakes. You see, one thing I always tell everybody, you can't be afraid to lose. You know, it's like getting in a car. You can't go in a car expect, like, I'm not going to drive, I'm scared I'm going to crash. I don't think anyone here has ever crossed their mind that they're worried about turning the key on and say, hopefully I'm getting a car accident today, you know? Because if you did, you'll never drive. You know, trading's the same thing, and that's where I think a lot comes into play.
So, you mentioned that the charts are delayed. Now, you're not talking about delayed charts. You're talking about real-time charts, right?
They're real time, but you know, like, but 5 minutes, you know, we look at a 5 minute chart, by the time that bar kicks in, it's 5 minutes has already passed. You understand?
Mm, yeah.
So, you know, and then people are like, well, how many, what do you use? Like, and I'm not talking about tick charts. I'm talking about, which we'll talk a little bit later. I'm talking about, you know, how about just following the high frequency trades? How about just following the big block orders and following time and sales? You know, like I did a whole class today, with my students about time and sales. With a group, and people like, oh, now the light bulb just kicked in because the time and sales, the chart gets its data from time and sales. And you could see all the orders getting executed just by following time and sales, and then you'll know why that chart's going to follow along. You know, if you become a very good day trader, you know, Andrew, your listeners will understand that because people think it's very risky. Day trading's not risky. It's actually the easiest thing out there to do. It's swing trading, investing is a lot more riskier because whatever happens over the course of the day will trickle down to a swing in investment. You become a good day trader and you learn how to be disciplined, then you'll know if you want to swing trade the stock or get out of it. And that's where the issue comes.
Well, let's just get back to the whole idea of time and sales because, you know, you mentioned that, but I don't know if everybody really understands what that means. Okay. So explain what time and sales and by the way, time and sales data is not available, for example, in real time on some of the freebie sites. It's just not. You know, you'll find throughout the day maybe some of the order flow, et cetera, but you need something, whether it's in, you know, eSignal or TradeStation or NinjaTrade or whatever it is, whatever you're going to use. But
anything that's not free, Andrew.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
You know, it's the only thing. You know, everybody wants free, 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 but they don't realize the only thing that's free is the cheese and a mousetrap.
Yep.
You know, my father always told me, he said, listen, you never want anything free. And I tell everybody this because that means they want something from you and you're not going to give it up. I'd rather pay a dollar than get it for free because at least I know, you know, I don't owe anybody anything.
Yeah, and some of the stuff is not that expensive, and it's the cost of actual doing. It's the cost if you're going to trade, and I'm talking about day trading here for a second. It's the cost of doing business. I mean, that's the bottom line, right? Do you have an internet connection? It's not like you could say, "Hey, you know what? I'm going to trade without an internet connection because I don't want to pay for it." So it's kind of part and parcel of the package of your toolkit, of your office, of your desk, of your, you know, your general way of doing business during the day, if you're going to do it on a quote-unquote day trading basis. But explain what time in sales is.
Yeah, that's a great question. Time in sales, I mean, even if you look at, if you watch CNBC, you watch the TV stations, if you watch the ticker on the bottom and you see those trades, those are new bids and offers. That is actually like a trade went off. Now, the time and sales window on more of an advanced execution system, it's basically like a little box where every time there's a transaction that takes place, if you buy a stock, you're buying it from somebody. It has to be confirmed by the exchange. And that time and sales, that window, that is on the execution system. So whenever there's a trade that goes off, it will be posted in that time and sales window. And then not only that, and more and better than that, you can adjust the colors in that time and sales so you know where the transactions are taking place. For example, if trades are going off on the offer and sellers are selling it, you'll see time and sales come up in green. Now, common sense, see a lot of green. Green means stocks going up. If you see a lot of reds in time and sales, means that there's a lot of trades going off on the bid, it'll come up in red, and in theory, you'll just know that, hey, there's a lot of reds, people selling it to the bid, that means it's going to go down. And then the chart gets its data from there. So now the chart's reading off that time in sales and says, oh, the reason why it's going up on the chart is because it's what happened in the time in sales. And last but not least, what's very important about the time in sales, Andrew, and your listeners have to understand, is that the time in sales is going to show you the volume. Because when some people like volume bars and like, well, how do you know that there was a big transaction that took place? Or maybe you're seeing a big order out there and don't know if it's somebody, if it's real, or the guy is just canceling it, just putting ghost orders out there. Well, time and sales is going to give you that confirmation, because when it gets there, you'll see if the guy is getting executed and sells these what we call big iceberg orders, or if he's just, you know, changed his mind. You know?
Yeah, and I know that when I was in your class, one of the things you also had other colors where you adjusted. You had a yellow. Yellow was like, wow, you own the stock. Yellow is good to buy an over the
ask. That's gold.
Yeah. And a purple. Purple, if I'm not mistaken, this is a number of years ago I did this course. Purple was where they're buying below, or they're selling below the bid.
Right. And yellow means you can adjust the colors if they paid above the ask price, meaning they want to pay more. Because remember, the exchange it's a negotiated business. So, you know, everybody is advertising what they want to buy the stock for, and you could see everybody's bids and offers out there.
Right.
And that's why, you know, sometimes that's just a strategy I kind of teach more at an advanced level. And it's funny you say that, Andrew. I mean, we're talking about, how long has it been? What, 15 years
yeah,
now?
Yeah, probably 15. Yep.
15 years since we trained. We worked together.
It's stuck in my head.
Yeah, it does. That and no overnights, too,
right.
Remember?
Exactly. No overnights. Yeah, one of the things in this course I remember was that it was a multi-day course, and throughout the entire course, every once in a while, maybe every couple of hours, after every couple of break, he would open up a big page that you would see on your screen. It would say, no holding overnight under any conditions, any circumstances. No overnight holds. Mm-hmm. That's what day trading. And that makes it, by the way, that right there, that is why day trading, true day trading, intraday trading, one day trading, if you will, during market hours and maybe, you know, after hours, but during the same day, that's why trading this way is actually not as risky as people think, because you can't have any. Well, you can have halts. You can have halts. Let's say that. But aside from that, you have the idea that you're not going to hold for a period of time over. So the overnight action and activity, and maybe the news items and things like that, that usually cause stocks to gap up or down, are not present in that kind of trading mechanism.
That's right. And the reason why that happens is that people don't do it into design. You know. The reason why people lose money, because that's why swing trading is a lot more riskier, because what happens is people try to day trade, and then they don't want to take a loss, and they says, well, maybe we'll come back tomorrow, and now we make a day trade into a swing trade, which wasn't put into design, and that's how they blow up their account.
Yeah.
You know, and that's how it gets, but that's, I mean, listen, whenever anyone is interested, you know, come and join me, listen to some of my events, and I'll tell you some great horror stories. That's not one I have not heard.
But I'll tell you something, and seriously, I'm going to tell you folks that are listening that I really highly recommend, and I'm not paid by Faust or anything like that, but I do highly recommend that you check out the various courses that Fausto has, because if, you know, attending some of these teaches you one or two things, I mean, that's just a gold mine right there. And the fact is that if you are a trader of any sorts at all, and you're using whether it's indicators that we have, let's say on TradeStation, or the whole package that we have, or you're using just, let's say, a 5-minute chart with a moving average, or whatever it may be. We talked about this with Brian Shannon last week, you know, some of the 65-minute, the 1690s and all that. We talked a lot about the concept behind it, but now let's get into the execution side of it and understanding really how the underlying market works for either a stock or an ETF or whatever it is, and how to actually pick out the stocks that you are, you know, potentially looking at. I want to skip over to a question, though, about, you know, what makes a good trader, and again, we're focusing on day trading, but what makes a good trader and what makes a bad trader?
What makes a good trader versus a bad trader? A good trader is someone that's going to learn from great traders. A bad trader is the type of guy that someone wants to be self-taught. That, I mean, it can keep it as simple as that. You want to be a good trader, you surround yourself with great, good traders. You want to be a bad trader, don't get educated, you know, don't learn from anyone, don't get a mentor, and just sit in your basement and just figure it out on your own. Mm. I can't shoot straighter to the hip than that. I mean, and I get very upset, Andrew, because I know there's a lot of people listening that are those people. You know, they're like, they want to do this. They know they do it. Listen, who doesn't love trading? I mean, it's the greatest job in the world.
Yep.
You are your own boss. You could do it anywhere in the world. It pays, you will never find a salary in the world that will pay you as much in the finance industry ever, you know? Without being a CEO or something crazy, you go to school anyway, regardless. You could do this with very, very little money, but nobody wants to take the time to learn to do it right. And,
yeah,
you know, a lot of people have their IRAs, and, you know, nobody wants to deal with stockbrokers anymore and whatever. You could do a lot yourself, and, and that's why I love to do it. But it gets me really upset. And
well, don't get upset. Nothing to be upset.
I hate to see people losing money because
all right.
It's just ignorance. It's just, you know what I mean? It's just like,
I understand.
Just, don't you get it?
I get it. No, listen, if you want to be successful at anything, you have to learn from somewhere, somebody. By the way, I'm not talking about school, like, you know, college kind of concept, right? I'm talking about in the trenches. I'm talking about as they are doing it, showing you kind of an apprenticeship in a way, right? I mean, that's
exactly
the concept.
And it takes more than one person, Andrew, to learn. Like, listen, like you do these great speakings all the time and listen to great people. Listen, I know for a fact that you always pick up one or two things like, wow, I didn't know that. You know,
of
like
course.
You know, like, yeah, and you're like, that's what makes you a great trader, you know? But for somebody, and then sitting in, and like, listen, you taking my class a long time ago. You were a great trader then. What made you better? That's because you know, like, listen, if Fausto could teach me or someone else could teach me, you know, I could learn, it's going to make me better, I'll do it. And that's what everyone has to realize, that you just can't say, oh, I already took somebody from somebody and that's the person. Sometimes it takes a few people to learn what you like, because some people have different strategies. Maybe the way they present a little bit different. Maybe you understand the way they do things a little bit different. But not that you'll never learn from somebody you learned before, but you know, sometimes it takes a few people to listen to. And then what I tell everybody, find that person, and that's the person you go with to say, okay, I sampled everybody's, but you know what? I kind of like, it's like going to the doctor's office. You know, you want to get three, what's it called? You want to go for
opinions?
Yeah, three opinions. You know, he's not going to go to the first doctor and says, oh, we're going to do this procedure, and oh, you need surgery. And the other guy would be like, you know, tell you something totally different. And the other guy teaches you to tell you something totally different. And then you're like, you know what, this guy makes more sense. And not only that, with the internet today, you can look up anybody,
You
know.
But that reminds me, there's a story, you know, a guy goes to the doctor, you know, he doesn't feel well, but he doesn't think anything's wrong with him. He goes to the doctor, first doctor says, oh, you need surgery. Yeah, I'm going to get a second opinion. Goes to the second opinion, second doctor says, you need surgery. I'm going to get a third doctor. Goes to the third doctor. Doctor says, you need surgery. His wife says to him, you know, see, I told you you need surgery. He says, I'm going for one more opinion. Goes to the next doctor. The doctor says, you don't need surgery. He says, I knew it. I'm not getting surgery. So it's all, you know, the fact of the matter is that you got to know who to listen to, but you also have to culminate all of that data inside without predisposition and pre-opinioning of what the situation is, which leads me into the next question, which is how do you find a great stock? So a lot of people have predetermined ideas on what stock they're going to trade. Now, maybe because they know a pattern that has been playing out over and over, or maybe because I don't know, maybe because they like the stock for some reason. They shop there. They do. They have you know, shoes made by that company, whatever it may be. But how do you actually go from
Skechers today?
Yeah, exactly. So how do you go in just with a clean plate, just absolutely nothing in front of you, no ideas, nothing? Okay, here I am. I'm an open book. I'm a white piece of paper. How do I find a trade that's going to be something really beneficial?
Okay, now that's a great question, and it all depends on what kind of trader you are. Now, if you're a swing trader, obviously you're doing it. There's a lot more research that's involved. There's more fundamentals involved. There's more technical analysis involved. So you're doing it, like I do some swing trading. I'm not going to say I don't. There's some great companies I like because I know the companies. I know where they're going, and that's a different animal. Now, if you're a day trader, you know, I might have a company that I'm long that I'll short over the course of the day. Day trading, you don't care about the company. You don't want to know what the company's doing. It doesn't matter. Okay, all you care about is making money. Let me give you one example. If you look up a stock, and if anyone looks it up, look at the stock like VLTC. Okay, VLTC, Icon actually bought it. It was an April Fool's stock that I traded, and it went from $1, and yesterday I think it closed as high as $22. All right, it's up almost 2,000%. Now, first thing people ask me is like, "What was the company do?" I'm like, "I have no clue. I don't care. It was going up. It's up. What's more important to you? What the company does, or it's up 20? It's up 2,000%. You know, it was up like 50% every day, 30%, 10%. So day trading, we just trade in and out of it. Now, could you swing trade that? Yes, but listen, and some of your listeners are probably going to check today and like, but I understand, Fal, so the stock is down 50% today. Who cares? I'm day trading. I don't care where it is today. It's where I was yesterday. You know?
Yeah, it's where you were when you had the stock and when you were trading it, right?
Right. Like, I run a professional trading room, which you know, and I tell people, listen, why don't you come and join my trading room and see and listen and learn and what other students are doing, and you'll see that we trade these. It's not where it is today. It's where we had it then, and you could ask them. So it all getting back to your question, how to find that with a white piece of paper, well, first of all, you have to realize what kind of trader you are. Are you an investor? Are you want a swing trade, or do you want a day trade? Because they're three different animals, okay? Day trading, you're going through the top 20 list. You're finding the big top 10% movers. You know, the TradeStation's got a great platform. You know, what tells you doing that. You go out there, you find those big movers. You work together with a group of traders, and you trade the stock and just make your day's pay. That's it. Swing trading, you know, you're looking to make the 20%, 30% a year. You're trying to find that stock that's going to do that. You hold it for a couple of days, a couple of weeks, maybe a couple of months. And then investing. It's, you know, that is how you start. So first, what I always tell everybody is, if you want to get, you want to listen to a couple of speakers, make sure, you know, find out who says that are swing traders, see who's an investor, see who's a day trader. And by the way, you can't do all of them. Okay?
Right.
So,
definitely not. Because you'll mess with your head. Your head will be all clogged. I understand that. And I understand that because we run a portfolio that, for example, one of our strategies is we'll call it part swing, maybe someday, but also investing. And, you know, you got to kind of think through that because the investing component of it, you know, something's moving against you in one day and your day trader hat comes on. You're like, well, why am I holding this? Or it's moving the other direction. Maybe I should add to it, for example, whatever, you know, on a day trade basis. And you know that stock is an quote-unquote investing stock, and you're going to kind of put that aside and not think about it. But it kind of gets into your head, and it gets confusing sometimes.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. You know, and like for example, let's talk about one of the like day traders. This is what we look at. We unfortunately, catastrophes are where we make most of our money. So I'll talk about one big catastrophe where the white cop shot the black kid. Okay, so now being a catastrophe, what had happened, but how do you profit from that? Well, now, you know, people are like, well, how could you basically profit from that? Well, now the mayor comes out and says, well, I want all the cops to get tasers now.
Yep.
You know, so where does that happen? The stock taser flies. And people
right.
are like, why is taser going up? It's up almost like 30%
right.
in like a week. They didn't even sign a contract, you know. And then the cameras, oh, now we want everyone to have cameras. So GoPro took off. And then, you know, I mean, it's just like, you know, 9/11, same thing here, and Hurricane Sandy, you know, with the generators and Home Depot. So it's all relative. So traders look at angles, you know, just like oil. Why is oil taking a catastrophe? You know, it's all relative.
It's all short term. So it's all short term. Yeah. Now let me ask you and finish up with chart patterns. I know you teach a lot about chart patterns. Can you kind of like verbally tell me some chart patterns that are the ones that you look at and that ones that you think are the ones that you want to follow on a regular basis?
Yeah, that's also, I know that's been an issue with a lot of people because everybody listens to so many, gets so confused, you know, and, you know, I always say technical analysis paralysis, you know, that all of a sudden they start slapping every indicator in the world and then just forget about, like, how do you evaluate it? Well, first of all, if you want to learn how to read charts, first of all, you should clean with a clean slate and just look at a bar chart, you know. Look for the support resistance levels. Now, what I teach my students what to do is, you know, most people can't answer this question that are great chart readers, but what makes a chart is supply and demand, okay? It's only what happened in the past. It's not indicative of the future because stocks could break support and resistance levels. So what I kind of teach people, my strategy, how I teach people how to trade is what we do is we look for something called iceberg orders, which we all know, some of you know, which are called high-frequency trades. So we'll look at that. We'll look at level three. We'll look for the high-frequency trades. And we'll see for those big block orders, 5,000, 10,000, 100,000 share orders. And then we'll try to match it where those support and resistance levels are. And that will give us a game plan where to buy it and where to sell it. So when it comes to chart patterns, it's you know, as much as you see support and resistance levels, we know support and resistance levels get broken all the time. But the question is, how do you know it's going to break it? Well, to have a resistance, you better have a big seller out there. If there's no seller out there and you know you're coming up to a resistance levels, well, guess what? It's going to break it because there's nothing to resist it from going higher.
Right.
Same thing with support levels. And that's basically a really good foundation of how I teach and the method I was trained by traders here down on Wall Street living here in New York of how to just keep it simple, which we call the KISS method of just following the money.
Yeah, you know what? And you know our techniques when it comes to some of the indicators we have over on TradeStation, and the same thing holds that we're always looking for not only just support and resistance from a standard line in time where there was this level, but more so give me the support and resistance that may be in between where we may see that there was a lot of trading happening at a particular pricing level, you know, this is called market profile. And we look at this and kind of find those and kind of fine tunes it because I really want to know where the big orders were placed, not just the orders.
Exactly, because that's what's indicative of what's going to happen over in the future.
Right.
So and most people don't have that game plan, so they keep get harping over the chart and not following the orders. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. But you know, once again, I'm a day trader, and day traders keep it like if anybody who comes and watches me trade, which everyone you know is always invited to, we'll tell everyone later how they can come and see me trade live. But you'll see, I keep things very, very simple. 70% of it, what you have on your screen, you're not even going to need. But once again, it depends what kind of trader you are. You know, if you're a swing trader, then you do need all these bells and whistles. You need to analyze it because you're not making your purchase on the split moment. You're not buying on impulse. You're taking your time. You know, day trading, it's like, boom, the stock's taking off. You got to jump on the wagon and just, you know, make that day's betting.
Yep. How can they get in touch with you? It's over at cybertradinguniversity.com. Where else?
Yeah, well, basically what they could do is they can call 877-70-CYBER or they can go to www.ctu.co. It's a new short version of Cyber Trading University. Right on the homepage, you can register for one of my free webinars. I've been teaching for 20 years. Our main business is just webinars. I don't travel anymore. It's more cost effective. And plus, I got three wonderful little boys. I want to spend more time with them.
Your wife must be thrilled.
Yes, she is. She does. She, you know, believe it or not.
No girls. I wanted a girl. Fausto, I wanted a girl.
You know what? I tried for the girl. Apparently, I only made boys.
Yeah, it seems that way.
The third one was on a good bottle of wine. It still didn't work.
Yep, I hear you. All right, make sure to go over there. It's www.ctu.co or cybertradinguniversity.com. Also, you can call them up. We'll put all that information on the show notes for this particular episode over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Fausto Puglisi, thanks so much for joining me.
Andrew, it's always been a pleasure.
All right, thanks, buddy. See ya. For all of you that do want an education in trading, day trading, I would really very, very highly recommend you check out Fausto's work that he does over at Cyber Trading University. I had some questions I wanted to get to, some listener questions. Of course, you could always email me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. But there's a few questions that have been stacking up that I thought I would get to. For those that we don't get to on the show, I try to answer those directly. But this question comes from, actually, there's no name on here, and probably I think you'll understand why after I read this to you. Says, Andrew, I really like your shows, TDI and DH Unplugged. Quick question about market mechanics. If I were to sell a share of stock I owned way below the current price, say it's trading at $10 and I sell it for $5, wouldn't I blow the shit out of stops created and probably brief price reduction? So the first point here is, and this is interesting, in theory, you would think that if there was a stock trading at 10 and you were to put in just a bunch of sells, either a short sell or a sell at 5, that you would really crater the stock. The problem, though, is on this that, first of all, markets are geared to give you the current bid price, the best execution price on that. So if you actually hit it at 5 and it's currently trading at 10, you probably get 10. Now, the only caveat to this is if it's a very thinly traded stock, yes, you would cascade that down. And you probably hit a bunch of the stops that are out there and you count, you know, you move the stock down dramatically. But if it's a very liquid and well traded stock, you know, think of a stock like Apple or something like that, any stock for that matter, that's, you know, traded pretty well, you'd have to really do a major number on bringing that stock down, whether it's pre-market, you could do it, or maybe even if it's, you know, during the market hours, but it's a very thinly traded stock. You have a stock that you trade 500,000 shares per day. You're probably not going to really do any damage to it. It, you know, if the stock trades at, let's say, $20 or $30, unless you're willing to really pound it down with some real money of your own. So just because you actually put the price in lower doesn't mean that it's going to trade at that level. So the question goes on to talking about the whole idea of pump and dump. So the whole thought of, well, you know, I'll do this on a regular basis and I'll buy some puts and all that. Again, the point here is unless you have a very thinly traded stock, you're not going to really move the needle that much. This question comes from Eric from Knoxville, Tennessee. He says he's a relatively new podcast listener. Thanks so much. He has a question regarding interest rates, something I haven't really heard discussed, but love to hear us comment about. He didn't major in college in economics at University of Florida, go Gators, but from where he sits, he says, I'm limited to my understanding. I question whether the Federal Reserve can ever afford to let interest rates rise again, at least by any meaningful degree. I'm not talking about a single quarter point hike. I'm talking about rates until we, like we used to see, maybe a 3-6% range. First, the interest on the national debt would explode, consuming a significant portion of the discretionary part of the federal budget if anything approached normalized rates were achieved. Politically, it's hard to imagine Congress or this or any White House getting control of deficit spending. Doesn't seem that no matter what party's in power, the evidence suggests that a balanced budget are hard to get to, or it is hard to get to. And without some type of balanced budget, I don't see how the deficit can be tamed. Anyway, as rates rise and the cost to fund the deficit rise along with it, the pressure on the Fed by politicians would be enormous, forcing them to back off whatever rate hike program they'll be doing. Second, any rate hike in interest rates would severely hurt the value of the Treasury and mortgage debt assets on the Fed balance sheet. I never heard anyone comment on this scenario. Yeah, we talked about this. Eric, this is, first of all, your points are well taken, and it's absolutely true. I don't see any way that really meaningfully the Fed can get out of their current interest rate debacle. The fact of the matter is that currently the way that interest rates are set up, with the fact that they own trillions of dollars of debt and the fact that the U.S. government is able to provide these, you know, put out bonds at such a low cost, it's good for all of those on that side, creates a lot of liquidity in the system, and that's why we're seeing this whole market move up on every dip that is out there is bought, on every fact that even some of the earnings are soft. Liquidity is there, interest rates are low, borrowing can continue, housing market is improving, and businesses are able to do a lot of work on the buybacks, as we've talked about, on the area of mergers, acquisitions, issuing their own debt to clean up their own balance sheets, et cetera. So, yeah, you're spot on with this. There's no question about that. Absolutely spot on. All right, here's another question we have from Jeff. It says, Andrew, assume that I have been tracking a natural resource sector, and I believe that it will go up. And let's also assume that a newsletter I read recommends a particular small cap stock because they believe it will go up at a significant multiple of that sector. It could be gold, natural resources like natural gas or oil. It doesn't matter. Even though I might see nothing wrong with the stock, is there any reason I shouldn't make a bet in the sector by buying a leveraged ETF instead of the individual stock, like JNUG or UGAZ, JNUG or UGAZ? Please let me know if it matters if I intend to hold short-term, medium-term, or long-term. I assume that this is a general enough question you can answer it. If not, I'll understand, etc. Your friend in Long Beach. All right, so here's the thing. When you're looking at a stock and you believe that it will do, you know, well, and you're looking at it maybe because it was recommended by a newsletter, for as an example, and it's something that you trust and that you believe in and you're going to be investing through. At the same time, you're looking at the sector. There's a couple of things. First of all, not all stocks will actually be represented by the same movement of the sector. You may have a really good stock in a very bad sector, and it is very highly possible that that sector may not do well where the stock will. Look at what's gone on with oil recently. If you invest in the oil sector, just the services companies, you would get obliterated. But there's a couple in there that actually held up pretty well. The other question that you're asking me inside of this is whether or not a leveraged ETF can be used. Now, again, if you're going to be doing a short-term trade on a specific sector and you believe that that is going to be what you want to do because you like the sector, I would possibly use a leveraged for a short term, whether let's just use it under a month, just as a time frame for this specific question. On the other hand, I would probably lean towards the side of investing in the stock itself if in fact you think that the sector is strong and the stock will do well. Now, the only negative to this is that obviously you're picking one stock. And if you're wrong, what will happen is you're not diversified, you're not broad enough. And what happens is that it is possible that the stock doesn't play out the way you thought it would, and the sector maybe goes up and the stock goes down. So you may be in a good sector and a good stock, but for whatever reason, that stock doesn't do well. Maybe something happens with the CEO. Maybe one of their particular products doesn't do well. Maybe there is some accounting issues and irregularities. There's a lot of things that can go on there. So I think that not to give you an answer that may be too benign, but it is possible that maybe what you want to do is a combination of the two. Maybe you want to invest in that stock or a stock that is with that stock and another stock like it so that you can have some diversification and possibly even pepper it and add to the positioning with some access to the ETF to give you more of a broad-based approach so that if you are wrong on the actual stock selection, what will happen is that you can actually do better by having the underlying ETF. Does that make any sense? Kind of give yourself all benefits and all great opportunities to make some money by having both the underlying security that you like as well as the broad-based sector that it's involved in. Just an idea. But anybody that has any questions that have been sent in, thank you so much. If you want to send a question, ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. All right, I wanted to just talk about for a moment the whole issue surrounding Greece and what's going on there. If you haven't been following the news, well, Greece is in trouble. Greece is in big trouble. They have been really just unfortunately at odds with the Eurozone. They're trying to, ever since the recent elections, they're trying to back out of all of the austerity programs that are going on there that supposedly were put in place to make sure that Greece would get rid of the bad debt and the excessive debt that they had and to refinance and rebalance their entire structure, making sure that the unemployment rate gets better, making sure that things just get a lot better there because the country was failing. Now, when we look at all of the economics, the employment, look at their output, look at everything that's going on in the country, I really can't find any real significant benefit from all of the austerity and that has gone on over the last number of years. We still have a very extremely high unemployment rate. The country is running out of money. Money's being pulled out of their banking system at a very, very high rate. And, overall, they're miserable over there. And the new election came in and they said, you know what, screw you. ECB, you know what? Hey, Eurozone, listen, enough of this crap. We can do a much better job. We don't need this austerity. And you know what? We do need your money. But we're not going to play by the rules anymore that, you laid out for us because we're not finding that is really helping our economy anymore. And now what's happened is that there was a time period. April 9th was this limitation, the day that was a day of reckoning where Greece was going to run out of money. Well, April 9th came and went and Greece is still humming along, but they have done some things recently because they're not getting the backing and the tranche of additional tranche of monies that were supposed to be released to them because they're not following the rules. They're not coming up with an agreement that says, hey, we're going to do all these things that you require us to do. They're very late on any requirements. They're dicking around pretty much with all of the process, hoping that the Eurozone is going to find it so intolerable that they're just going to release the money anyway. It's kind of like your kid saying, hey, daddy, can I get $10? I want, no, but please, no, please, please. You know, this goes on and on. And finally, dad caves in and says, all right, here's a 10 bucks, just leave me alone. Or here's $5, just leave me alone. So Greece is taunting the Eurozone, coming to meetings very unprepared, doing what they can to really stall. And it really hit a head at the most recent meeting where the finance minister was discussing with the Eurozone the various plans and methods and things that they put into action, which really amounted to pretty much nothing. Now, what happened was, I guess tempers became, you know, just to a level that just boiled over, because the Eurozone officials started razzing and just throwing all sorts of names and insults to the Greek financial minister. They said he was an amateur, a gambler, procrastinator, and very unflattering discussions. Now, this is not something that usually goes on in a public meeting like this. You know, usually people are pretty much reserved, diplomatic, and they say things like, you know, that have an undertone of maybe some negativity. Not this outright insult that goes on. And I think they're right, because he is an amateur at what he's doing here. He's acting as an amateur. He's acting as a gambler, looking to really press the Eurozone to a point that they just can't do anything about it and, you know, hopefully getting money out of them and not coming up with any kind of significant plans that are at least a compromise. We've been back and forth on this for months now, and there's still no, first of all, agreement of any sort. There's no idea by anybody, I think, at the Eurozone entirely or anywhere else that sees any kind of solution to this except for Greece exiting, which would be a disaster, by the way. Even though they talk about how they're much better off set and they're not going to have a major catastrophe and any kind of contagion, they're going to have contagion. Don't let them fool you by the words. Don't let the politicians fool you. There is going to be major contagion because it's going to put a halt to some of the financial underpinnings of the Eurozone and the Euro. Not to mention the fact that if, in fact, they pull out and things go well, you'll see a cascade of other countries trying to do the same. Portugal and Spain, possibly even Italy, being the three that really come to mind. This will be negative for Germany, negative for France, and for the Euro bloc entirely. Now, I don't want to see this happen, because I would like to see some kind of compromise made here, because I think that, yes, the austerity programs have been a little bit too drastic. On the other hand, Greece has not held up their end of the bargain in a lot of this, and their finances are in disarray, and you know, the fact that they still can't do anything internally to get their country going, it's not just because of the austerity programs, and it's not just because of the major oversight that's put upon them by the Eurozone, because they got that in return. They received billions of dollars of bailouts. They have not put it to good use. Their government is still playing like it was years ago, not really realizing that, hey, you know, we need to also take responsibility. That's the problem with Greece. They're not taking the responsibility of their own well-being, of their own finances. And that's a shame. It hurts everybody. Now, this is just not just a commentary on what I believe and what I feel and my opinion, but it's a real look at the fact that Greece needs to come to the table with something that is palatable for all parties. They can't just expect the Eurozone to simply say, okay, listen, you don't want to play, we'll still give you money. You don't want to play, you're going to miss your payment to the IMF, don't worry about it. We'll still fund your banks through the various programs that we have available for them. Greece needs to come to the table soon with anything. Even if they want to play it more to their advantage, I would still like to see that Greece comes to the table. Now, I think I mentioned to you some time ago that we have a small position in the National Bank of Greece with the opinion that, first of all, even if the Eurozone says to Greece, go screw yourself, you're out, or if Greece says to the Eurozone, hey, you know what, screw you, we're out. However you want to look at it, there has been already a run on the banks. Whatever the next news is should be possibly beneficial because at least there'll be a break. They're not, now, Greece will not let their bank go under, their major banks. They can't. They'll find a way internally to figure this out. The Eurozone doesn't want their banks to go under either. So it's not a guarantee. It's not an absolute. It's just it's an investment based on probabilities. The probability that we see is that things are bad, and clearly at $1.20 or $1.25, the National Bank of Greece, if you look at their share price, is in pretty bad shape. But if something breaks on the benefit of the Eurozone and Greece and things come together, you'll see a major rally in that stock. That's our opinion. If it doesn't come together, we're kind of towards the bottom here, maybe a little bit lower. I mean, say one more flush out here. But again, the belief is that nobody wants these banks to go out of business for 1,001 reasons. So it makes sense to possibly take a very small position in this. So think about that and go from there. Well, some more stocks, more ideas, more on the economy, more questions answered on our next episode. I hope you are there to participate and come along. Every weekend we release a new edition, new episode of The Disciplined Investor. Tuesday nights and Wednesday you'll get DH Unplugged. Make sure to check that out on iTunes or any other place that you get your podcast, or listen to it online at dhunplugged.com. And of course, all the show notes and everything about this episode you'll see on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Check out the Aero strategy, check out the global allocations and the TDI managed growth strategy, which we manage for clients, $50,000 minimum investment. All the information's on the website as well. You can grab it at your leisure. I thank you for joining me. I'll see you again next week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.